Washington, Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session. The Honorable Marlon J. Applewood presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Counsel. For Mr. LaForge.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Rebuttal time?
4 minutes. May it please the court, Casey Grannis on behalf of Armando LaForge. There's no debate in this case that error occurred when the charges against Mr. LaForge were amended down to non-automatic decline offenses. The adult superior court should have transferred the case to juvenile court. That didn't happen. That's the error. The debate.
Well, isn't the error that no one raised it?
No one raised it. Ineffective assistance of counsel. That's an alternative theory for error here. Yes.
What's the other theory?
Straight up error that the court.
I mean, we're here on a PRP, aren't we?
That's right.
So it's not like an error on appeal.
That's true.
Okay, so you get past the time bar, because it's characterized as a jurisdictional issue.
Correct.
Once that's passed, then what? Then what is the, you know, your theory has to be not just I get past the time bar. Your theory has to be what is the basis for review? Is it a constitutional error, or exactly what is it? It seems like it's ineffective assistance. That's the way these other errors, other cases have reviewed it. What's different about yours?
I would disagree that all the cases look at it as ineffective assistance, although, again, that is one theory posited here. But if we look at the DeHuge case, the Supreme Court ended up resolving that issue, the decline error, same type of decline error at issue here. They resolved that on the basis of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for not raising it on direct appeal. So the underlying premise is that if it had been raised on direct appeal, then the relief would have been afforded. In that case, the relief sought was, it was dismissal or, failing that, a new trial after going through a decline hearing. In this case, Mr. LaForge is relying on that, basis of error, the same basis of error in DeHuge, to argue, look, once we get down to the merits of the error, the remedy has to follow. And the debate here is what the scope of the available remedy is. LaForge is seeking, ultimately, resentencing as a juvenile in the event on remand.
It's true, is it not, that what this is about is lifetime community custody?
He has been sentenced to a lifetime of
community. I mean, should you obtain what you're after, which is a sentencing in accordance with the provisions of the Juvenile Justice Act, then the difference that would be made in practical terms in your client's life would be relief from the lifetime community custody? Or is there some other practical change that would occur in his life?
The practical effect is the relief from the lifetime of community custody, yes.
Thank you.
He's already done his confinement time.
That's right.
So community custody is what's at issue here. Now, the state's arguing that, well, in terms of available remedy, we look no further than Dillenberg and DeHuge. Send it back for a decline hearing. If it's determined at that point that juvenile jurisdiction would have been retained, then all LaForge gets is a new trial. That's the state's position here, as I understand it. Case law subsequent to Dillenberg and DeHuge, so that there's another remedy available here. And that's what we've been talking about, is the resentencing as a juvenile. And for the authority for that, we rely on the Supreme Court's decision in Posey 2, to be specific.
But that's Posey 2 and Maynard. But once you get past the decline hearing. I mean, do you concede that the remedy is to have a decline hearing, or do you object to that?
Well, I'll say this. In the absence of the state's concession that decline would not have happened, as occurred in Posey 2, the stronger argument is that the remedy is remand for the decline hearing.
All right, so then...
That's assuming, though, that the decline hearing is feasible at this point, which is another argument.
No, you make that argument. And, and as I understand, the decline hearing would be de novo.
That's right.
And do you take a position on whether the decline hearing would occur in juvenile court or superior court, recognizing they're both the same? I mean, one is a...
My understanding is that it occurs in the adult superior court division. And that,
but the adult superior court would be acting as though they were in juvenile court,
yeah,
in looking at whether decline should have been.
Basically, yeah. My understanding is that the, you know, the adult division of the superior court places itself in the shoes of what a juvenile judge would have done had the decline hearing been held back in the day. And in this case, you know, 12, 13 years will have passed by the time that happens, and that's...
And that's your argument. Your argument is it's that too much time has passed to have an effective decline hearing?
Well, maybe, and that's one of the arguments, is that the case should be remanded for a threshold determination of whether a feasible decline hearing can be held at this time. We don't know at this juncture whether it can or not. It's going to depend on the facts on the ground, and that's got to be developed at the trial court level. But we could see the specter of it being a problem because of the passage of time, especially in relation to two of the Kent factors that need to be considered at this retrospective decline hearing, the maturity and sophistication factor, and also the prospects for rehabilitation. Those are time-sensitive factors because we have to travel back in time, essentially, to figure out what the facts would have been back then.
Do you anticipate that an argument could be made under the new Supreme Court cases like Miller, Roper, et cetera? Particularly Miller.
In terms of the constitutionality of the automatic?
In terms of whether special thought has to be given to sophistication and maturity on the age that he was at the time. But under law that has changed since that happened.
Yeah, under law that
has changed. Not that that's something this court would decide.
Exactly, but I could anticipate that type of argument being made at the trial level, yes. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kristen Relier, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County, representing the state of Washington. Mr. LaForge was properly charged in adult court. He was properly prosecuted in adult court, and he would have been properly sentenced in adult court, but for a very important technical defect. The remedy for this error, it is clear, based on decades-long Washington Supreme Court precedent, is to remand Mr. LaForge for a retrospective decline hearing. It's undisputed that Mr. LaForge...
How does your position then differ from what Mr. Granis just got through arguing?
Well, it was a little unclear to me because defense counsel's briefing suggested that it might be possible to just shortcut the decline hearing, to skip by that and go straight to a juvenile sentence. And I certainly would argue that that is inconsistent with the case law and the statute that requires a decline hearing. So just from the outset, our position is that Mr. LaForge should have a decline hearing. You can't skip over that requirement. And I do not believe that...
And that is the remedy that, would you agree that that's afforded to him on the basis of ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, no, because...
You were conceding that he was entitled to a decline hearing. Were you also conceding ineffective assistance by not having sought a decline earlier?
I would absolutely concede that he's entitled to a decline hearing. There was an error. I would not concede that there was ineffective assistance of counsel.
Why not? I mean, obviously somebody, either the prosecutor should have raised it or his attorney should have raised it. You know, I'm not very interested in saying the Superior Court on its own should have raised it. So you've got two actors. So, I mean, either it's the state or the defense attorney, and why not the defense attorney?
I think when you look at it, if you just step back here, this defense attorney negotiated a very favorable resolution for Mr. LaForge. By way of this plea deal, Mr. LaForge had 5 years, at least 5 years, shaved off of his sentence. And this is a procedural trap that has befallen defense lawyers, prosecutors, courts for over 60 years.
But as I understand it from reading the briefs, it was the practice to have a waiver of a decline hearing at the time, and that did not happen here.
That's correct. That should have happened. There should have been an agreed waiver of due
process. So one of the attorneys should have prepared that waiver.
Yes.
And somebody did not.
Yes.
And so even though a favorable plea agreement was negotiated, there was no waiver that was thought about.
That's correct.
And cases that have preceded this talk about ineffective assistance of counsel, and in analyzing it find that the prejudice is the failure to have the hearing.
Yes.
So?
Isn't that what happened here?
Yes, I would agree with that. I'm just saying constitutionally, was this ineffective counsel, and I'm arguing that it's not. You might disagree with me, but Mr. LaForge has to show both ineffective counsel and obviously prejudice.
We don't have the benefit of the plea agreement and whether or not there were sentencing recommendations or there were stipulations about juvenile court or adult court.
Well, we do have the plea agreement. I attached it to my response, and I believe Mr. Grannis did to his. And we do actually have a transcript. It looks a little funny, but it's a transcript of the sentencing hearing that was prepared long ago. But it's clear that there's nothing in the paperwork, or at least in the transcript of the sentencing hearing, that anyone talked about juvenile court jurisdiction.
I am wondering if the reason why you're resisting ineffective assistance is because, I don't even know why you are resisting it. I mean, I noticed that one of the differences, you're taking the position that for there to be ineffective assistance, you have to show that the decline hearing, if held, would have come out favorably to him. That is not, that argument, that little nuance is not based on the prior cases, which do not go that far. And so I'm wondering if are you trying to water down the standard that an appellant who is in this situation has to meet for ineffective assistance? In effect, you're trying to raise the bar and saying not only do you have to show that you didn't get a hearing, but you have to show how the hearing would have come out.
I am arguing that. And part of the reason I'm arguing that is because the only case that I'm aware of that we have on it is In Re Deluge. And in that case, the Washington Supreme Court, didn't address whether or not trial counsel was ineffective and make a holding on that, because they said that at the end of the day it would be the same remedy, which would be a new trial, a decline hearing, and if it was found that the juvenile court would have retained jurisdiction, then there would be a new trial. I'm not meaning to water down the ineffective assistance of counsel.
Or stiffen it up, actually.
Right, or stiffen it up. No, I don't mean to do that. No, but I do not believe that Mr. LaForge can make that second showing of prejudice here. He can't show
if there is such a requirement.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So why is it? I understand that you would like to make it harder for him to prove that, but why are you trying to avoid having it? I don't understand either one of you. You're both trying to sort of sidestep ineffective assistance, and I don't understand what other way it could have gotten to us on a PRP. I mean, it's not being raised on direct appeal so that we would review it as an error of the trial court.
Right. Well, I'm trying to think. At least in It's not uncommon in this context, because at least in fact,
it is common to do it by the way of ineffective assistance. In fact, cases do not show any other way.
I disagree with you there.
Okay.
Dillenburg was a habeas corpus petition, but then In Re Deluge was a personal restraint petition. And the Washington Supreme Court did not address this issue of ineffective assistance of counsel and reaffirmed Dillenburg and sent Mr. Deluge back for a decline hearing. I might note 10 plus years later, because the passage of time is not uncommon in these cases. And I would say that this case is actually much better off than most of these cases, because here Mr. LaForge has a sexual deviancy evaluation, which we still have, a pre-sentence investigation report, which we still have.
Well, that all goes to the question of whether the court can, this is the argument that there's not enough information for the court to do it. So you're saying there is?
There absolutely is. The Kent factors are ascertainable here. Yes, even on the ones that you might be concerned about, the juvenile sophistication and maturity, you're asking about Miller, you can, in this case, much better than other cases, come to a sense of that, because those documents I was referring to do address Mr. LaForge's, in 2004, his social history, his family history, educational, criminal history, and even provide a risk assessment. And I would note, to my point about passage of time, the Williams case was the Washington Supreme Court decision from the mid-60s. In that case, the decline hearing was held 15 years later. and the Supreme Court still affirmed. So the fact that there is a passage of time shouldn't necessarily, does not mean that we cannot have a decline hearing, and here we actually could. I would just note that Mr. LaForge did get what he bargained for. This was a case that belonged in adult court. It was a violent stranger rape at knife point. And he negotiated a plea deal where he received a significant reduction in the charges against him and in the prison time. Having gotten what he bargained for, he now seeks to get more, which is to be free of lifetime community custody, which is significant. But the case law and the statutes are clear that the remedy for this is a decline hearing in adult court, where if...
Do you agree that that the decline hearing that is held in adult court, if the court finds that he would not have been declined, is the court then free to sentence him in accordance with the provisions of the Juvenile Justice Act, as occurred in some of the more recent cases?
No. And I would just like to take the last bit of time to distinguish Maynard and Posey, which are the cases that defense counsel is primarily relying on, and point out that Maynard and Posey both belonged in juvenile court. In Mr. Maynard's case, he was deprived of an opportunity he should have had. He should have been made aware of the state's very favorable offer of a deferred disposition. In Posey, the state conceded that Posey never would have been declined. Here, Mr. LaForge never would have been adjudicated in juvenile court. This prosecutor never would have agreed to amend the charges against him if she had realized that it would trigger the potential of a decline hearing and possibly only a year and a half sentence, particularly because Mr. LaForge had already pretty much served a year in custody by the time the charges were amended against him.
I don't actually see how that answers my question. I mean, in other words, you're saying that you're basically asking us to assume what would be, you know, your preferred result of a decline hearing, which is that he would be declined. But my question was, suppose that for whatever reason, the trial court, the Superior Court, when you go back there, doesn't agree with you and says, you know, I think he would have been declined. Okay, so assume that. Then is the court free to sentence him in accordance with the provisions of the Juvenile Justice Act?
No.
Having made the decision that you would prefer that they didn't make?
No. To be clear, if juvenile court retained jurisdiction of Mr. LaForge...
Back then?
Yes, back then. And if we have a hearing and they were to retain him now, it's clear, based on Dillenburg, that he would get a new trial in adult court and that he would be subject to an adult sentence. Dillenburg and Deluge answered that, and Maynard and Posey have not overturned Dillenburg and Deluge. Thank you.
I don't mean to give the impression that I'm running away from my ineffective assistance claim. It's just that I want to keep both theories of error in play here. But turning to the ineffective assistance claim, we have a situation where, you know, it's not a matter of trial strategy or any sort of strategy. It's obvious it's oversight, because what we have at the sentencing hearing is we have the defense attorney arguing to the trial judge, oh, treat Mr. LaForge as a juvenile, going so far as to ask that he be sent to a juvenile facility. So it's clear that, I mean, defense counsel was hoping for the benefits of juvenile sentence, but was hamstrung finding himself in adult court. That shows the deficiency. And the prejudice is, it goes down to, okay, he didn't get the decline hearing. You know, the state's arguing, well...
Now the difference between you and the state emerges, which is that you would like, in that instance, if he is not declined, that you could have a juvenile sentence, which would potentially or certainly, I don't know which, eliminate community custody, whereas the state says, no, even if you got that far, you wouldn't get that. You'd just basically get the same adult sentence, which is what he has now.
Right, and that's the crux of the disagreement we have with the state. And, you know, when we look at the ineffective assistance claim, that's where Maynard is particularly helpful, I believe, is because Maynard recognized, okay, when you have an ineffective assistance claim, when juvenile jurisdiction is improperly lost based on ineffective assistance of trial counsel, the remedy must be tailored to the harm. And in that case, the remedy was, resentencing in accordance
with... Well, so the state says, well, this is just like Deluge, and Deluge has not been overturned, which is true. So I take it your response is that, yes, but this particular argument wasn't made in Deluge. And how else would you distinguish this case from Deluge?
One is that, yes, the argument wasn't raised in Deluge. It wasn't raised to the Supreme Court, never, or in Dillenbrook for that matter. And the Supreme Court never had a chance to pass on this theory of relief that LaForge is seeking now. The other way to think about this is that in light of the case law that's developed since the Hughes, of course, I'm talking about Posey 2 and Maynard, where, you know, Posey 2 was the first time the Supreme Court recognized that even if an offender is now over 18 years old or over 21 years old, that there's still no bar to resentencing as under the Juvenile Justice Act as a form of relief when juvenile jurisdiction was improperly lost. And if we get to the point in Mr. LaForge's case where the decline hearing is held and the court on remand determines, yes, juvenile jurisdiction would have been retained, then we're faced with squarely with that question. Okay, resentencing as a juvenile, is that available? Not raised in DeHuge, not raised in Dilbert. In fact, in DeHuge, it's totally understandable why.
Is it strictly necessary? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that DeHuge had already finished his sentence by the time his personal restraint petition was heard. So he was gunning for dismissal and failing that, a new trial. So it's understandable why DeHuge didn't argue what LaForge is arguing now, because LaForge is still doing his sentence.
Is it strictly necessary for this court to reach it? I mean, in other words, you want a new decline hearing. Would it be, why is it proper for this court to say, and if you give him one, then this is what you can do?
The lower court needs guidance on this. This court could step back and say, we're not going to tell the trial court what to do in that instance, but then the case is going to come back, or may very well come back. And then
it's not going to come back if the court's...
Well, it depends, right?
We don't know.
But again, that seems like, I understand Your Honor's concern. I'll just finish up here. But that same type of judicial restraint idea could have happened in Dillenburg and DeHuge, but the Supreme Court in those cases and other appellate cases still went that extra step to say what should happen on remand.
Thank you.
Thank you.
State versus Olson, please.